The fifth kind.
When you're talking about that strata of society, those people at the top of the top of the top, who really are the owners of this world, who really do control governments, they don't look at the rest of the world the way we look at each other. Lundberg studied all of their people, and he said they do not look at the world the way you think that they do. You are a pawn for them. You are to be used by them for their purposes. You're not really fully human in their opinion, in their judgment. Yeah. They're fully human. They're the ones who have the right to make the decisions about the world.
Welcome to the Fifth Kind TV. Today we're very excited to welcome to the show Richard Dolan. For the past 25 years, Richard has been a tireless researcher into UFO phenomena. Richard is a fantastic exemplar, in my view, in the field through the wonderful way he sifts through and assesses and filters the fact from the fiction. And Richard's courage and diligence and integrity have given him an almost unique credibility in the field of UFO research. Richard, welcome to The Fifth Kind.
Paul, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
I am really looking forward to talking to you today. I mentioned the integrity of your reportage, which I think has been really vital in inviting wider demographics into the conversation. But personally, I love the energy that you bring to the subject, because whenever I see you talking on this, you look like you're enjoying yourself. You look like you like your job. And I love that, because many people, when they get into this area of research, I think it's very easy for people to become angry, frustrated, and they can become somewhat difficult to have a conversation with. But for me, you make this area of exploration inviting, and you motivate me to want to find out more.
I'd love to hear it.
I wanted to say that right at the outset. We're going to talk about various topics today, but I would really love to begin with yourself and ask you, how did you first get hooked into this topic? And particularly given how financially challenging the life of a researcher can be, what's kept you going? So what got you hooked, and how is it that 25 years on, you're still in the field?
First of all, thank you for all of us. Awesome things you said. I do have an enthusiasm for this subject that has not abated. There are times when I feel less than stellar about the field itself, but even that, I mean, I've met so many amazing people. I love doing it. But as far as how I got into this, I was, I've said this a number of times, 25 plus years ago, I thought I had a different life path, and that was in the academic world. It was a world that I loved. It was a world that I, you know, from my late teen years through my 20s and early 30s, through my years working in as an undergraduate and getting my bachelor's degrees and my years in the graduate programs and master's degrees and PhD program, I thought that this was very congenial to me. I enjoyed the lifestyle. I liked the university setting. I got along very well with all of my colleagues and professors. And so that was simply what I thought I would do. But in the early 1990s, two things happened. One was I was not happy with my dissertation research at the time. I was not happy. This is not to demean anyone at my alma mater, the University of Rochester. They had a fine program, but I just didn't feel like it was happening for me. I was working on I did 100 pages of a doctoral dissertation on U.S. Cold War strategy circa 1950. And I was trudging along with it, and I lost my excitement. I think that's really what it was. And I think the academic world was really starting to disillusion me. I was in my early 30s when I had a conversation with a professor about the JFK assassination. So it's 1994 when I had this conversation, and he had a book in his hand that I had happened to read not long before. It was by a man named Gerald Posner called Case Closed. It was why Oswald supposedly had done it all by himself. And I remembered reading that book on the advice of a friend of mine, and I read it, and I wasn't a JFK expert, but I was able to pick apart why that book was so terrible. In fact, me being a smart mouth, in the hallway, I'm talking to this professor who's got the book in his hand. He was using it to teach in his class. And I said, "You realize that book's a piece of crap, right?" It's exactly what I said. And he said, "No, really? Why?" And I rattle off about five reasons off the top of my head why that book was so terrible. And I'll never forget this moment. He said, "Oh, I understand. You're a conspiracy theorist." Now, in 1994, as a young academic wanting to be into that world, that was the worst thing he could have said to me.
And the ultimate insult.
Yeah, it's like in the movie Lord of the Rings. You remember that in the first episode where Frodo is with his other hobbits, and the riders are coming for the first time, and the cinematography, the video is so brilliant. It telescopes out in this surrealistic way. People who remember that, that's how I felt. I thought
it was like that.
I felt like I'm on a cliff, and if I take one more step, I'm going to go off that cliff, and my reputation will be ruined in the academic world. I'll never forget it. And we resolved the conversation. We laughed, and I went about my way, but it was chilling for me because I realized I'm in the Department of History. We don't have really a lot of grant money coming from governments. We're pretty much all on our own. We're independent. There's no institutional pressure, at least in theory, on me to pursue my intellectual interests. And yet here I was, and something as mundane as the JFK assassination. And in that department at that time, you were not allowed to discuss something as interesting as the John F. Kennedy assassination. So it was a moment where I realized I don't actually know that I want to be in this culture anymore. So I was going through all of these tribulations and dealing with a dissertation that was interesting me less and less. And then I stumbled into the UFO subject. I was in a bookstore and I saw a copy of Timothy Good's classic Above Top Secret, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And I'll never forget picking the book off the shelf thinking, wow, everyone talks about UFO cover-ups. And for me, I had trained myself to thinking it was all nonsense. But I was curious. I will definitely say that. And I remember leafing through his book thinking, oh, I see these are allegedly genuine documents. And I see this person is in this book. And I remember reading his diaries. And I read all about this department. And wait, what? He's got them in this UFO context. So it was this moment of like what I often call cultural schizophrenia, where you're ensconced in what you realize is this official establishment truth that you're supposed to believe. But here's this other potential truth that's quite radical. And I think I was at the perfect age. I was 31, 32 years old when I threw myself into it. So I was old enough to have a good foundation in my education, but I was still young enough to be to have the energy and to have the guts to throw it all away and to try this something new. I think if I had encountered UFOs even 10 years later or 10 years earlier, I don't know if it would have worked for me, but it was perfect at that moment. And I just made a decision. I thought, I've got the rest of my life to live here. And am I going to just run out the clock, you know, getting some adjunct instructing position, hoping to get tenure at some little college somewhere, or am I going to do something that's exciting me and that's causing me not to sleep at night? And so I didn't even make the decision all at once. I spent about a year or a little more than that living both worlds. I would sneak UFO books into the University of Rochester. Like, God forbid anyone saw me with them, but I carried them around with me. And I even remember one time I left some books behind and some colleagues or professors, I mean, it's so crazy to say this now. We're in 1994. And I think I was in this mortal terror that some professor had seen a UFO book that I had. You know, isn't that crazy? But I went through a year of that. And then I just decided, you know what? I've obsessed enough about this subject. And this is going to be my dissertation. This is going to be the subject that I'm going to throw myself into. And then it was the next 5 years of writing UFOs and the national security state. That was it. That was education.
That's so interesting, because evidently then before you picked up your first book on ufology, something, that conversation with your professor had clued you that there are official narratives that may not be true and that we're not allowed to question. And that was a really important preparation for you, wasn't it, to come to this whole area and be willing to look behind the veil, as it were?
Most definitely. Back in the 1980s, I was fortunate. I spent a summer to study German language in East Germany. It was a communist bloc Germany. It was 1986. I had a really wild time. I met a dissident family that were fascinating people. They became my friends. But I remember being fortunate to go around with these two brothers. They wanted to party. They took me out to all these cool places in Berlin and other parts of Germany. But they also had friends who were like, one friend, I was in the living room of this gentleman. He had been in prison not long before for political purposes. And I observed how when the East Germans were talking about the really important things that mattered, they were whispering in their own living room about how they were listening to West Berlin radio, for example, even though the signal was jammed, but they were able to listen to it. And I remembered thinking, I was 24 years old, that I said, wow, this is like a schizophrenic society. Like, you've got official truth, but you've got this actual truth. But years later, I realized that's a universal concept. Of course, now we all realize that. It took me a while to figure that out. And it was UFOs that opened the door for me.
I can really relate to that. I'm just fascinated at what happens the moment a person can see some daylight between an official narrative and something that may have actually happened. It seems to open up Pandora's box.
That's right.
And they're willing to question everything that they've been taught. And for me, my journey into this kind of area of exploration began as I began to see daylight between this familiar, because I come from a world of ministry, Christian ministry. So I see daylight between the familiar stories that we tell from our ancient texts and what's actually in the ancient texts. And it was anomalies in the ancient texts, beginning with Genesis and my studies there, and then other world mythologies, that made me begin to question whether we might actually have a memory of ET contact embedded in our ancestral narratives. And that's what got me going. And so you can imagine, coming from a world of ministry, my thinking has had to adapt a few times as I've exposed myself to new data. And that's a journey I'm sharing at the moment in my book, Escaping from Eden. I wondered for you, in your 25 years in the field, there must have been moments when your thinking has evolved and you've been exposed to new data and you've thought, I'm going to have to change what I think about that. And I wondered if you could share something of the evolution of your thought over the 25 years you've been in the field.
I'll try. I will just say, first of all, it happens all the time with me. That has not stopped. And in fact, it's almost kicked up into a higher gear in the last couple of years. And it was happening this very morning. I'm in my library and I've got it set up finally. Once again, it's set up well. And so I'm plowing through my books the way I like to do. And it's constantly a challenge. But when I started in 1994 was my first year where I really threw myself into this. And I was of the attitude, I got in so cautiously, so conservatively. So back then, my worldview had evolved into, I don't want to say it was a straight up materialist worldview. I don't think that's quite right, but it was a very conservative, cautious, materialist direction. So I guess I would encapsulate it by saying my attitude was, well, I'll study UFOs, but I don't want to study anything weird like abductions or crop circles. My initial question was very simply, not even were UFOs real. I remembered explicitly telling myself, I personally don't care what my thoughts are. I said, I only care what is the historical likelihood that the United States military has been engaged with this and that they're interested. Like, the, all I wanted to know is, are they interested? And if they're interested, why? And my own opinion, I kept telling myself, is irrelevant. And sometimes I still try to come back to that attitude. In other words, I mean, opinions, everyone's got an opinion and they're fallible, but I wanted to know what are the facts. So I started out very, very careful, very factually based. The problem is the UFO subject is a deep, 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 deep subject. So you can make a choice. You can stay at the level that you're comfortable with, that I was initially comfortable with in 1994, or you can keep going into the deeper waters and see what it's like. And so what I discovered is that over time, it's like the waters pulled me in deeper and deeper. And the next thing I knew, I was swimming into the depths. So for example, my first questions were on 1940s and 1950s declassified documents. So was there a military, were there a series of military encounters with the UFOs? Well, that was easy to answer. The answer is yes. And then yes again, and then yes many more times. So that it became obvious that the United States military, and this is through proven, declassified, unarguable documents that come from the United States National Archives, the United States had, and not just the U.S., nations around the world, I discovered, had ongoing encounters with objects that were not supposed to exist. Case closed. They were disc-shaped. They moved in ways that we had no way of understanding. They were silent. They could zigzag. They could instantly accelerate. Everything that we hear about the, you know, tic-tac UFO of 2004, pilots were encountering these in the 1940s, and indeed, actually, earlier still. We have limited records on that. So that was interesting. And for me, the way my mind has always been, I'm insatiably curious. I can't just shut it down. I can't just say, all right, I got that solved. The government was interested. Yep. And then to go onto the fiction, which so many people do, of saying, well, I don't know what they are. Hey, the U stands for unidentified after all. Like, to me, that's a cop out. You can take it if you want, but that's not for me. I'm curious. It doesn't mean that I'll have the answer, but I like to think about it. And I like to puzzle it out. And I asked all the logical questions that analysts in the 40s asked. Is this U.S. black budget? Is this Soviet, Russian, anyone else? And of course, you come up empty, really. You come up empty when you start looking at these possibilities. And that's when that moment is when it gets really interesting. But I went through many, many phases of development. In the early, very early 2000s, I discovered some really good artificial intelligence writers, people like Ray Kurzweil and Damien Broderick and number of others, and AI, and then remote viewing. This is all long, long, long time ago. And to me, those interested me.
Yeah.
And then the connection with the UFO subject interested me a great deal.
Yeah.
Remote viewing in particular, once it became evident to me that that is a real phenomenon, I got interested initially in remote viewing because I realized these guys all saw UFOs, or at least they claimed to see UFOs. They claimed to see extraterrestrials. And I thought, if that guy can see a Soviet submarine while it's being built in 1979 off a Soviet dock, that's Joe McMonagall, then I'm going to take, and if he's proven right, which he was, then I'll take him seriously on other things. And the same for people like Ingo Swann and Pat Price. So studying remote viewing just in and of itself blew open my notions of what I thought physics was and what I thought reality and space and time were.
Really, I'm so glad you said that, because I wanted to ask you specifically about that area of remote viewing. My introduction to it, other than a few personal experiences, was reading the John Ronson book, Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh,
I was introduced to it by a skeptic. And it's a book I enjoyed reading, but that I don't like. But what it told me was that there's been serious money invested by government agencies into exploring and using remote viewing in the modern era. And the use of remote viewing by intelligence agencies goes right back to the beginning of intelligence agencies as we know them in the 1500s when Queen Elizabeth I set up, what was it, to the beginnings of MI5. And so that's right.
Yeah.
And so to realize that governments take this seriously made me think again about what it is, my glimpses of remote viewing. I was introduced to that from a spirituality end of things. And this really shifted my worldview. And I was going to ask you about it because, and you can tell me if this is off topic, but you're married to a remote viewer.
Yes, and, she's quite good.
I wondered if that had an impact on stretching your worldview further.
Maybe a little bit. I emphasize I was interested in remote viewing long before I knew Tracy. But it is also true that she and I have many great conversations about remote viewing. And I will definitely add that I've learned a lot about remote viewing since we've been together. So it has deepened my understanding of how it works, or at least what it is and what it isn't. There's still a great mystery to it. To me, there's a physics of remote viewing that we haven't fully explained. I mean, it's a simple question, really. How is it that a human being, any human being, is able to see something on the other side of the world, see something in another time? Even if you get some of these things wrong, or if you misinterpret what you're seeing, the fact that people can get hits to the extent that they do should never be the case, and yet it is the case. And for skeptics, all I will say is educate yourself on this. It is undeniable. So it says something about space. It says something about time. And it also may say something about causality, which is uncomfortable for me to deal with. And yet it's an unavoidable possibility that causality isn't what I grew up thinking it is.
Yeah. So
what is free will? What is all of these things? I mean, these are old questions. We're not the first to ask them, but remote viewing opens that up. But for me, when I mentioned it in context of my UFO evolution, remote viewing was really helpful because it allowed me to recognize that there are types of evidence that I can't always prove. So, for example, people will talk all the time about when they have an encounter with an alleged alien, that the communication is telepathic in one way or another. Now, we don't, to my understanding, I don't think we really have a good understanding of the physics of telepathy. Yes, I can understand a little bit. Extra low frequency wavelengths out of the brain. I'm no brain expert, but I read these things. So anywhere like around 5 or 6 hertz is very low meditative frequency. And those are longer waves that some have speculated might be more effective in transmitting information. So I'm willing to accept that as a non-scientist. But nonetheless, we don't really have a science of telepathy. Nevertheless, the fact that I know quite confidently that remote viewing is an actual thing makes me open to the at least possibility that consciousness and that, let us say, spirituality are factors in understanding this phenomenon much more than I would have wanted to admit 20 plus years ago. Because really, what is remote viewing? But spirituality factors into this. You know, what is it that can allow you to see on the other side of the world? Well, ancients had a word for that. They called it the soul. And maybe it's as good a word as any. I mean, there's probably more going on. Anyway, I think I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say, if I'm speaking to a skeptic on this topic, if I ask them, have you or has anyone in your family ever experienced a glimpse of remote viewing or precognition or a telepathic connection, everyone has a story. Everyone has had moments of this and glimpses of this. And the moment you pause and realize that, it ought to get you questioning, how does that work? Can it be developed? And the moment you realize that a huge amount of money has been spent on developing it by governments, you then have to start taking it seriously and explore. And it is part of many spiritual traditions, which was my introduction to it in the beginning. Now, to return to something you mentioned earlier, you talked about the Tic Tac encounters. And last year, something quite significant happened, because the encounters with Tic Tac UFOs in 2004 by the USS Nimitz were authenticated. And it seemed to me that there'd been a massive policy shift, because for 72 years, the official line had been one of silence and debunking. And we seem to have gone back in one hit to the pre-1947 position, whereby authorities were talking openly, saying, we're pursuing these things, we don't know what they are, we'll tell you when we find out what they are. And we seem to have gone back to that. It was a massive shift. I was surprised it didn't get more play in the news. I was wondering what you thought the significance of that shift was. Why wasn't it bigger news? Why weren't more people talking about it?
I think because it's not a monolithic shift. I think what we're still seeing within the United States power structure is a lot of infighting, and essentially we can call it power struggle. I don't know who all the players are, but it's clearly they're not at as one on this matter. So just to give you an example, I had a conversation with one journalist a little over a year ago, who is very, very deeply engaged in researching the organization TTSA, To the Stars Academy. And they're intimately involved in all of what's been going on the last few years with this. And I offered this journalist my own analysis of TTSA. And I said, I'd like to know what you think of this, which is essentially TTSA is I see them as a private faction that has allies and enemies within the Pentagon, allies and enemies within the intelligence community. And this journalist said, absolutely, that is true. He says, emphasis on enemies. So there's many more enemies than allies. There are absolutely hostile factions within the Pentagon and within the intelligence community against any form of openness and admission on the UFO subject to this moment. But the fact is, with all power structures, there's different opinions exist. And there have always been a number of smart and sometimes semi-influential people within structures of power who believe in some openness on this. I spoke to one, I've mentioned this once or twice in the past, one scientist. I had this conversation maybe a decade ago. This was a scientist who has had, and I think still has, high-level access to some very powerful people in the United States intelligence community. And he said to me that he knew for a fact that at deep, 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 deeply classified levels that there were scientists who had alien technology and bodies in their possession. Actually, his exact words, because he's so precise, was, at least one body that I personally know about, he said to me. But and there are more. But anyway, one thing he said to me was, he said, look, it is my knowledge that at every so often, every 5 or more years, there are conversations high level about whether or not to have a disclosure on UFOs. He said that he himself was on one occasion a committee member, a subcommittee member, that was charged with looking at legal ramifications of UFO disclosure, even though he's not a lawyer, he's a scientist. And he said, look, our conclusion was, this is too messy. There's just no way. We decided not to. I don't know what the other committees decided, but they all decided, nope, not this time. So, but there are factions and there are discussions that appear to take place. And I think what's happened lately with the Navy is, as one other insider said to me, it's just more, too much toothpaste is out of the tube. And it's, you can't get it back in. So in other words, they mean is, I always laugh and sometimes roll my eyes when I hear people saying that TTSA is some kind of PSYOP or a CIA operation. And I believe that those people who say that could not be more wrong. I'm not in TTSA. I don't have any skin in the game here, except that I'm interested in what looks to be true. And what I think is the case is that you have a group of private ex-Intel guys. Not all ex-Intel guys are evil. Some ex-Intel guys are actually really great. You know, William Binney of the NSA is one of them. Ray McGovern of the CIA is another. They're like are good people who have been in the intelligence world who then believe in telling the public true things about what goes on. Like that happens. And I think with TTSA, you have a private group of people who have their own interests, maybe philanthropic, maybe selfish. Who cares? They have an interest in getting some UFO information out. And they've done so more successfully than any individual or any organization that's ever existed, ever. They get some stuff out there, but they have enemies within that structure that does not want this information out.
The fifth kind. If you'd like to hear Richard Dolan go deeper into these and more controversial topics, go to www.thefifthkind.com for uncensored access to the full 2.5 hours of this revealing interview.
When you're talking about that strata of society, those people at the top of the top of the top, who really are the owners of this world, who really do control governments, they don't look at the rest of the world the way we look at each other. Lundberg studied all of their people, and he said they do not look at the world the way you think that they do. You are a pawn for them. You are to be used by them for their purposes. You're not really fully human in their opinion, in their judgment. Yep. They're fully human. They're the ones who have the right to make the decisions about the
world. Can I just go off script a bit? While I've got you, I've got to tell you this experience because it relates to something I've heard you talk about before, Richard. From time to time, people who contact me say, have you had a close encounter, Paul? Why are you passionate about this subject? And my answer has generally been, no, I haven't. My worldview didn't allow for anything other than God, the devil, angels, demons. Now looking back, I realized three things happened to me when I was 20 that I might read differently.